how do you evaluate the investment potential of a particular property? Well, that's what I'm going to discuss with you today as I share five metrics that we use at Metropole when evaluating the investment potential of properties that we're considering discussing with clients. But I'm also going to share with you one metric that you probably consider as important, but that we in fact feel is very misleading. Now, in assessing a property's investment potential, we've got a checklist of more than 100 metrics. I'm only going to share five of those with you today, but they're going to give you a good understanding of the balance of the science and art of property investment. And it's a mixture of both. But if you're not sure what I'm talking about at the end of today's show, you'll have a much better understanding. And of course, I'm going to share a mindset message with you, as I always do. But back to what makes an investment-grade property. Currently, there's about 10.5 million dwellings in Australia, and at any time there are a couple of 100,000 properties for sale. Now, sure, we're moving into a new stage of the property cycle where properties are going to perform much better, but you can't just run out and buy any property. Not all properties make good investments. In fact, in my mind, less than 4% of the properties currently on the market are what I call investment grade. You see, any property can become an investment. You just move the owner out, put a tenant in, and it's an investment. But that doesn't make it investment grade. To help you understand what I consider an investment grade property, let's look at some of the characteristics of a great investment in general. Things I look for in an investment class is something that's giving you strong, stable rates of capital appreciation. I look for steady cash flow. I look for liquidity, the ability to take my money out of my investment, whether by selling or borrowing against my investment. I look for investments that are a good hedge against inflation, that have got good tax benefits, and that are easy management. So how do you make money from an investment? Well, as a property investor, you make your money in four ways. You make it through capital growth. You know, the property increases in value. You make it through rental returns. That's the cash flow you get from your tenant. You make it through accelerated or forced growth. That's the growth you manufacture by adding value through renovations or development. And you also make it through tax benefits, things like negative gearing and depreciation allowance. So when people say you need to invest and diversify when you invest, it's very hard to diversify when you're first starting off investing because you don't have enough money to buy multiple properties. But what I just showed you was that even with one property, there's a diversity in the way you get your income. Capital growth, rental returns, accelerated growth, tax benefits. But let me be clear, not all returns are created equal. Capital growth isn't taxed, while rental returns are. And as your property increases in value, the rent will increase in value, generating more cash flow. So in my mind, capital growth is much, much more important as a driver of your wealth creation than cash flow. Now, clearly you need cash flow to hold onto your property portfolio. It's going to keep you in the game. It keeps you in while you allow the power of compounding of capital growth to kick into gear. Meaning you've got to have a financial buffer to see you through the ups and downs. You've got to have the right finance strategy. So you've got to be important about your cash flow and your ability to service your debts. And you've heard me say often that property investors don't recognize how important the game of finance is, that property investment is really a game of finance with some houses thrown in the middle. And so these beginning investors leave themselves open to financial woes by not having a rainy day buffer around. But in my mind, as I was starting to say, capital growth is the most important factor. Now, I know not everyone agrees with me, but I've been educating investors, and I believe reasonably successfully. I've probably educated more successful investors in Australia than anyone else. And I know that those who've actually built a substantial asset base have in general done better. So how do you find a property that will outperform the others with regard to capital growth? That's what this particular episode of my podcast is about. So, welcome to today's show.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropole, who specialize in helping you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now, here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
Today I'd like to have a chat with you about a number of ways to assess a property's investment potential and one thing that you shouldn't be using that a lot of people do. So how do you choose an investment grade property? One that's going to outperform the average, is one that's going to deliver you wealth producing rates of return. Well, you probably know by now that investment's part science and part art. The art component is the market intelligence that comes from decades of experience of buying and investing, on the ground experience. And this is crucial because relying totally on the scientific approach, the data, that just isn't enough. Yet I know there are some people out there telling you that's what you need. Just look at the data, don't get emotionally involved. Now, I'm not saying get emotionally involved, but you need the perspective that's on the ground. You see, statistics alone won't allow you to differentiate between what's a good floor plan or a poor layout, a desirable neighbourhood compared to a less desirable location, maybe one with a bit of a stigma about it, or it won't allow you to look at the attributes of natural light compared to poor orientation. You get the idea? When it comes to the numbers, the scientific component, I see many investors get swamped by a seemingly endless amount of numbers, and that can potentially paralyze them. It can give them that analysis paralysis. In reality, you don't need to know a million things. You just need to understand a few critical metrics in property investment. So while the list I'm going to share with you today isn't exhaustive, there are a number of the metrics that my team at Metropole use to help assess investment potential of the properties that we look for our clients. Now, one of the things we look at is the past sales history of a particular property. We look at the past capital growth to give us an indication of potential future growth. Now, you probably know that one of the rules we use at Metropole is our six-stranded strategic approach to buying a property in an area that has strong capital growth potential, one that's going to continue to outperform the averages, and that's because of the demographics in the area. Once we've confirmed the quality of the location, we then drill down deeper into the property itself, and the best way to gauge that particular property's potential growth, because remember, not every property in those good locations is going to perform well, but the way we gauge future growth potential is to backtrack its past performance by getting a history of at least two previous sales, if possible. You can't always do that. Now, this sort of information isn't available to the average investor, and that's where having the research department of Metropole on your side can help you. Anyway, while past performance is obviously not a guarantee of future performance, the basic fundamentals of a location or a property don't change. Clearly, context is important, which is why you need to compare the performance of a particular property against other similar properties in the area. By that, I mean 7% annual growth isn't impressive if the suburb in general has had a capital growth of 8% over the last 20 years. So it's got to do with the context where you're buying. Occasionally you'll stumble across a property with no prior sales history. It's been owned by the original owners for a long period of time. Of course, this doesn't mean you should discount it from your consideration list, does it? This is where a seasoned buyer's agent with an intimate local knowledge can be worth their weight in gold. They instinctively know what other valid comparables there are, ones that have sold recently. Again, this is the art part, the science and the art of investing. So the science is the data and the art part is knowing what's a real comparable, because the past performance of these comparables, hopefully you're going to be able to calculate those and they'll give you an approximate estimate of the performance of the property that you're currently looking at. So I'm working through some of the metrics that we use at Metropole to help decide, is this the sort of property that we're going to recommend to our clients? The second thing we look at is what's happening in the area at the moment, the days on market, which is a measure of how long it takes to sell a typical property in a particular suburb. And more importantly, the actual number is the trend. That provides a level of context. Clearly, when demand's high and there are more buyers than there are properties available, the days on market decreases. On the other hand, when the market's soft because of economic conditions perhaps, or because of a flood of new properties become available, then the time on the market, how long it takes to sell, the days on market increases. And in general, this drives down prices. Now, this statistic helps investors identify those locations that are strengthening so they can buy before the masses and therefore take advantage of the uplift by owning property over time. Now, again, this metric is not to be taken in isolation. We're not trying to time the market. But if you can get an understanding of what's going on, then it's worthwhile taking advantage of this particular metric. Let me give you an example. Cairns in Queensland, days on market about 12 months ago sat at 64. Days on market currently were closer to 82, which means it's taking longer to sell an apartment in Cairns than it did the same time last year. On the other hand, if we look at houses in, let's say, Kensington, New South Wales, the days on market have improved from 30 days 12 months ago to about 26 days today. This indicates a tightening of the market in Kensington, with more buyers actively looking for houses than are selling at the moment. However, keep in mind that no property metric should be looked at in isolation, as the market is a dynamic beast with many factors, many influences at play. A property can still be investment grade if all the other metrics are heading in the right direction and the days on market in that particular location is slightly increased. I'm just going through some of the metrics, not all of them, because we have about 112 points we look at when we select a property for our clients at Metropole, but some of the big ones that you can have a look at yourself when you're looking for an investment. The other thing we look at is the depth of the market. What we're looking here for is an assessment of the supply and demand balance within a particular market. This is a measure of how long it would take for the current inventory, the number of properties on the market, to be absorbed completely, to be purchased based on the current rate of monthly sales. Now, that's assuming there's no new inventory being added to the market. Look, depth of market's a term that's often used in the stock market as well, isn't it? Now, in property, though, a market's considered to be balanced if it has between, say, 5 to 7 months' worth of inventory properties for sale on the market. If hypothetically all the stock on the market, all the inventories of properties for sale, were sold in less than 5 months, it implies there's greater market depth. Lots of buyers waiting in line with an inventory turnover of more than 8 months. If it takes longer to sell all the stock on the market, it implies there's an oversupplied market with little depth of buyers. Now, to illustrate this example, let's have a look at the apartment market in the Melbourne CBD, a market that we know is currently still having an overhang from being adversely affected by the impact of COVID-19. Now, a while ago, the unit turnover in Melbourne already sat at 8.5 months. In other words, there was already a position of oversupply before we came into COVID. But fast forward to today, and it's estimated that the current sales level would take well over 16 months to sell all the apartments on the market in the Melbourne CBD. In other words, there's little market depth, not a long queue of buyers waiting to absorb the market inventory. We're seeing the same trend in some of the outer suburbs, predominantly made up of new house and land packages. Another metric we look at to understand whether a particular property would fit into our criteria of being investment grade is the location of the property and seeing the ratio of owner-occupiers to renters. While many beginning investors have their prospective tenants top of mind, an important strand of Metropole's six-stranded approach is to only buy properties with owner-occupier appeal. Now, sure, you want tenants from them, and sure, you want the right sort of tenants, but since owner-occupiers make up about 70% of our property market, they make the market. They add stability to property values in those suburbs where there's a predominance of established owner-occupiers, people who bought their homes many years ago and have got significant equity in their properties. So we look for those sort of areas, which is very different to the instability and the volatility we see in house prices in areas dominated by investors. Think the inner city apartment market or other suburbs where there's little scarcity and often many first-time home buyers who've overcommitted themselves and have little equity in their homes. So we look for suburbs where there's established money. Those areas have got a breadth of owner-occupiers who have got a portion of their mortgage paid off because they bought it 30, 40 years ago, and some have only bought 10, 15 years ago and have got less of their mortgage paid off, while there's others who bought more recently. But there is a breadth, and this is older, established money suburbs rather than the newer money suburbs where everyone's got a high mortgage and the mortgage is a large part of their weekly pay packet. Now, I've found owner-occupiers buy with their hearts and not their calculators, and they tend to happily pay an emotional premium if there's something unique or special about the property they fall in love with. By the way, that's another of Metropole's six-stranded approach: buy a property with a twist, something special, something unique, something different about it. But it goes without saying, like the other metrics I've discussed, this shouldn't be looked at in isolation. You need to layer one on top of the other. So what we're looking for is the right sort of property, but also the right location, one where there's a larger percentage of owner-occupiers than there are investors owning properties. Certain suburbs will always have a high percentage of renters, such as Bondi Beach or Potts Point or Elwood in Melbourne. Yet the right property in those locations also make great investments. So again, it's just one of the factors we look at. Another factor we look at in the location is looking for above average wages growth. Since property investment's a game of finance, and you've heard me say that often before, it's a game of finance with some houses thrown in the middle. It's important to find locations where the local residents have higher disposable income than average, and suburbs where the wages are growing faster than the state average. As it's in these locations people are going to be able to afford to, and often be prepared to pay more to buy their homes, to move into those areas, to upgrade their homes. These tend to be aspirational suburbs. You'll often find these suburbs also going through gentrification. You know, a change in fortune of the suburb as it's discovered by higher income demographics. This slightly pushes the lower income residents out. Think about Balmain or Redfern in Sydney, Elwood or Fitzroy in Melbourne, Tenerife in Brisbane, Brayden in Canberra. Gentrifying suburbs, aspirational suburbs, are suburbs where people have got higher wages growth. But interestingly, not just the owner-occupiers, you also want tenants to have higher wages growth as well. Remember, your future income as a property investor will be dependent upon your tenant's ability to keep paying you rent, but keep paying you higher rent. So we look for areas where tenants similarly are in the right demographic group who want to live there. Don't just rent because they can't afford to buy, but rent for lifestyle choices. We want tenants who are aspirational, who've got good income, who are likely to have increasing income, as I say. Your future income, as I said, depends upon your tenant's ability to increase your rent. So while we're looking for owner-occupier desirable properties, sure, we still have the tenant in mind. Now, be careful, though, relying too heavily on data. There's no doubt it's important to understand the property fundamentals and to research the data. And clearly, the longer you go back, the further in history you go back, the more accurate the data is likely to be forecasting future trends. The problem is, data's often wrong. Or to put it correctly, the way investors interpret data is often wrong. Let's be frank. You can make data, you can make numbers and figures say almost anything you want, can't you? I've seen too many property investors find a property they like, and once they become emotionally attached to it, then they find the data to confirm their decisions. This is called confirmation bias. They're using data backwards rather than in the right way. What I'm getting at is, why do you need data in the research phase of your investment journey? To be a successful property investor, you need much more than that. You need on-the-ground experience. You need on-the-ground perspective. Data's only going to get you part of the way. You must complement the data, as I said, with local area knowledge. And that's why our buyers agents at Metropole are excelling agents. They understand the local market drivers. They understand why one side of the road is more valuable than the other, or why one part of a suburb is in more demand than the other. This is the type of perspective that money can't buy. So property investors who only do their research on the internet, but don't have the on-the-ground experience or the context, have the science part of the equation covered, but they miss out on the art part of the investment smarts. Now, don't get me wrong, doing your research is a critical step in getting ready to invest, but it's only one of the many steps. There's no substitute for practical on-the-ground experience. Now, I'd like to share one commonly quoted metric that a lot of investors look at, but we at Metropole tend to ignore. After auction clearance results, probably the most commonly quoted metric is median price data. But in my mind, that's an unreliable metric and can lead to costly investment mistakes. Yet it's so highly researched by the property pundits. So here's five things you need to understand before you draw any conclusion from the regularly reported changes in median price. Firstly, let's have a look at how median prices are calculated. The median price is essentially the sale price of the middle home in a list of properties of sales that have occurred that are ranged from lowest to highest. So in a list of 11 sales, if you'd have the sale price of house number 6, where there's 5 lower priced and 5 higher priced prices above it, that's the median. Now, this is different to the average, which would have all the total of all the house price sales added up and then divided by the number of properties sold. Now, technically speaking, the median is more accurate than the average because it's less affected by a few unusually high or unusually low sale prices. But median prices in property are based on the homes that have recently been transacted. And in some suburbs, they're divided by units and houses. So that's what the median is. But the change in the median doesn't necessarily mean the change in your property's value has altered or the property that you're looking for to buy. Medians are a useful tool in understanding price changes of properties that have transacted. But a 10% increase or decrease doesn't mean that that's going to affect every property. In fact, the medians may have gone up and the value of the particular property that you're looking at may have gone down a bit. What medians do reflect, though, is the activity in the market. Look, I'm not explaining it too well, so let's look at it this way. If a number of multi-million dollar homes came on the market and all sold last month, this would raise the median price. However, the value of your property, your home, or the one you're looking at, a more modestly priced property, may not have changed at all. Similarly, a falling median price in an area could really just indicate there were more sales occurring at the cheaper end, as actually happened last year during COVID, when more established homes, people with more money, didn't sell up their home, but others who were a little bit more affected by COVID sold, so median property values dropped, but that didn't mean the upper end of the market dropped in value. So scrutinizing the type of properties that sold over the previous month or the previous period compared to previous data, that may be helpful. You may notice that there were primarily 3-bedroom homes sold, where a particular month had more prestige homes selling. So median prices don't necessarily mean all properties in that area have changed in value. Now, median prices are more valuable in some areas than others too. It's more meaningful where you've actually got a suburb that's more homogenous, where more of the homes are similar in pricing and in style. That makes medians, therefore, a more accurate reflection of a change in value. And suburbs where more properties transact on a more regular basis are also going to be more statistically significant than areas that are tightly held or where properties sell less frequently or are significantly different in style to each other. Similarly, suburbs that are far too large for the numbers to be meaningful, within them they've got good and bad locations, maybe on different sides of the road that don't perform the same, they're often lumped together. Or think of suburbs near the beach where, near the water or near a lake where on one side of the street there is a very different style of property to the other. So in some areas, median prices are more valuable, where houses are more homogenous, and in other suburbs, they're not as valuable. Similarly, relying on median prices for a capital city at a capital city level, that's too broad. It can be misleading. Medians are also misleading, as I said, where you've got two distinct markets in suburbs. And of course, median prices for houses and apartments are different as well. And they're also misleading in many of the new outer suburbs where the type of property sold a number of years ago may well have been vacant land and now it's been replaced with new homes, different sort of dwellings. And of course, the other area which can mess up the importance, the value, the significance of median prices is suburbs where gentrification is going on, where the locals are renovating their properties and change the nature of the property or the quality of the property and therefore the median price. So it's not really the same property being sold again, is it? Now, what I'm explaining to you is that median prices, the common statistic a lot of people look at, isn't one that we pay a lot of attention to at Metropole. But we do recognise that different data providers measure different statistics. And you've probably noticed that yourself. There are different measures of the median price growth in the states or in some suburbs. And that's because there are three key differences between the data providers: the data they collect, the timeframes they report on, daily, monthly, or quarterly, and the accuracy and complexity of the methodology they rely on. Now, one way this shortfall in median property values has been corrected is CoreLogic provider hedonic index. Their hedonic index seeks to overcome some of these issues by measuring attributes of particular properties, looking at the sort of properties they're transacting. They look at the number of bedrooms and bathrooms, the land area, the geographic context of properties, and that gives them a more accurate analysis so they don't compare all two-bedroom apartments or all three-bedroom homes. They compare them to other comparable ones. And this allows for a composition change in consumer buying patterns. So not all median prices are the same. And I guess the last message I'd like to give about median prices is that they're more reliable if you look over them over a long term. So you should pay less attention to the short-term trends, but of course they're the ones that are reported, and understand that median prices, as with all statistics, are more useful when viewed as a change over a long time frame. So this will give you a better understanding of what's happening to an area's performance. So they're best used as an indication of the composition of the sales rather than a good indicator of changing property values. And that's why I look at other data sets like sales volume, market depth, things that we mentioned a short while ago. So in summary, you've got to understand a whole lot of metrics because property investment is a combination of art and science. But if you understand some of the metrics I discussed with you, it'll give you a head start in analysing the investment potential of any given property. However, like any other parameter in property, the numbers may not mean much on their own, and there's a risk of drawing the wrong conclusion from them if you don't have an intimate, hyperlocal market knowledge. And that's because, as I said, successful property investing is part science, understanding the data, and part art, having on-the-ground perspective to interpret the data correctly. Now, perspective comes at a cost. The cost of time, the cost of experience, the cost of learning from your mistakes. You can't buy that perspective, but you can hire it by working with an independent property advisor like the team at Metropole. They'll help give you a level of safety to ensure your property selection is the best it can be. So as our market moves forward this year, now's the right time to get a good team on your side to level the playing field, but more than that, give you direction, guidance, and safety. So whether you're a beginning investor or a seasoned property investor, or looking to buy a home, my team at Metropole would love to help you formulate an investment strategy, or we'd love to do a review of your existing portfolio and help take your property investment to the next level. So why not go to metropole.com.au and find out about what we do and leave your details. It all starts by building you a strategic property plan that's bringing your future into the present so you can do something about it. And then we will tell you what's realistic, what's possible. Only once you've got a plan, then do we start with the science bit, the data bit. And once we work out what your budgets are and what your goals are and what your risk profile is, and then put a plan together, what your time frames are, only then can you start looking on the ground to see where to buy, what to buy, and use some of the metrics I discussed. So go to metropole.com.au. I'd love to be part of your wealth creation journey.
Now here's Michael's mindset message. Remember, a change in your thinking will lead to a change in your life.
In today's mindset message, I'd like to ask you, what is success? Because this podcast is more than just about property investment. I mentioned that it's about success, property investment, money. And if you're like me, you're interested in learning about success. You're interested about reading about successful people. I enjoy reading about their habits, their philosophies, their behavior, and the influences of those people who've actually already achieved great things. Not only do I find it motivating, but understanding how and why successful people do what they do, I pick up tools, I pick up ideas how I can improve my own life. So back to what I asked initially, what is success? Well, as I researched it over the years, I came to realize that success has got many different definitions, depending upon who you ask. The dictionary definition of success is the accomplishment of a goal, the desired result of an attempt, or that one succeeds. Now, I know many people think success is all about money, fame, and power, but the many stories of unfulfilled lives or the burnout amongst so-called successful people shows, however, that success isn't solely about achieving possessions or attaining goals. In my mind, success is a life that's much more than money and power. It's defined by your actions about how you live your life. So what is needed for you to succeed in life? And I've come to the conclusion there are six essential aspects to happiness and a successful life. As I work through these, have a think about them. How do they fit in with you and with your goals? And do you agree with me that these are the essential aspects of happiness and success? Now, the first one's physical health. You need to be physically healthy to have the energy to engage in life. If you don't have your health, you can't function. You can't be truly successful, can you? The second one is mental fitness. You need to be continuously engaging your mind, learning and growing, experiencing new ideas, getting better, pursuing mastery, and putting your ideas to work to accomplish your goals. So for me to be truly wealthy, you need physical health, but you also need mental fitness and wanting to keep growing. You also need emotional health. You need to be self-aware emotionally. You need to feel good about yourself. You need to have a positive self-image. If you're depressed to the point where you can't function, you can't be successful. Now, I recognize that for a lot of people, this is out of their control. So again, I'm not giving you any medical advice, but I'm suggesting that if you are having emotional or mental health problems, don't be embarrassed. Seek help. Ask for help. We're working through the six essential aspects to happiness and success in life: physical health, mental fitness, emotional health, and I also want to suggest social health is important. You need positive relationships in your life and people that love you and support you. You've got to have friends and loved ones you can trust that make you a better person, that inspire you to be better. Basically, humans are social. If you don't have people who care about you and that you care about, you can't be successful, can you? The fifth element you need to be successful, well, in my mind anyway, is purpose, meaning, spiritual health. You can make a positive impact in other people's lives. You can give meaning and purpose to your work, to your daily life. This keeps you focused and inspires you to overcome the day-to-day struggles and setbacks that are part of everybody's life. Every day I get a couple of emails from people who listen to my podcast, who read my blogs, who read my books, who tell me about their successes and how I've inspired them. That makes my day. That gives me the purpose to continue producing these podcasts. And then the sixth element that you need for success is material wealth. Of course you do. These are the basic levels of food and shelter and clothing that all people need, and that's paid for through money. If you're poor, if you're too poor, if you've got too much stress, struggling financially, you can't be successful. So you can function and be happy in the short term without all of these elements, but in the long term, if you're missing one of them, it's unsustainable and you're probably going to become unhappy. So, of course, something's going to have to change in your life for you to become more successful. Emotions are how your subconscious communicates with you. They're one of the reasons humans are so resilient. So if you're unhappy, it's probably your body's way of telling you something's wrong with you or your life. It's probably telling you to do something about it. So as I said, I've come to the conclusion that success is the drive for long-term sustainable happiness. In the short term, you can find happiness in all sorts of things. Instagram likes, money, partying, small wins, YouTube, TV, alcohol, shopping, movies. But in the long term, if you don't have those six elements, those six essentials that I talked to you about a second ago, you're not going to feel happy or successful. Of course, don't compare yourself to others. Don't worry about what others say or do. Only you can know if you're truly successful or not. And this is only the case if you're on the path to happiness over the long term. I hope you've got a better understanding of some of the things you now need to look for when trying to find an investment-grade property. As I said right at the beginning of the show, less than 4% of the properties on the market are what I would consider investment-grade. Of course, there's lots of investment stock out there. Don't confuse the two. Those properties built specifically for investors like the new high-rise developments, they're still littering our cities, yet most of them aren't investment-grade. But if you got some benefit and some understanding of the role of science and art in property investment and some of the metrics you should be looking for, if you got some benefit, why not help somebody else who you know wants to get involved in property investment this year as well? My aim is to help as many Australians become financially fluent and become financially free through investment in property. So why not help me by sharing the details of this show? There's a share button on every podcast app, or just tell somebody about the Michael Yardney podcast, or leave a review on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to this show. Now, I'm back twice a week, but in between, if you'd like to keep up to date, why not follow me on social media? Just look for Michael Yardney, or join our private Facebook group. Go to Facebook and look for the Property Update Facebook group, where I give you regular and exclusive content. In the meantime, I'll be back real soon. Have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney podcast, which was brought to you by Metropole, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney Podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropole to help you?